This is Ryan.
And this is the Nickel Film Podcast, episode 45, the movie podcast of Gamers Anonymous. If this is your first time listening, thanks for joining us. You can download previous episodes on iTunes. There you'll also find the Nintendo show, as well as the soon-returning and revamped John and Carlos show. And you can always listen to previous podcasts on our website, www.gamersanonymous.com. On today's show, we're going to review Pontypool and list our top five bottle plays. But up first, you wanted to discuss a recent death, a very sad death.
This is very sad, and I don't want to be the angel of death here. But earlier today, Don Cornelius took his own life.
We should say that today is Wednesday, the first of February.
Yes, and this is very sad. And for those that don't know, Don Cornelius was the creator and host of Soul Train, and he is just such an iconic figure in the world of music. I thought it would be appropriate, even though we're a movie podcast, to talk about the passing of a true icon and a legend. There really isn't anybody else I can think of that could eclipse a death. Maybe like Dick Clark. If Dick Clark died, that might be a little bit bigger news than Don Cornelius. But really shame to see him go. And in honor, I put together a nice little mix of funk tunes, and we'll have a nice mellow listen today as we're discussing our movies.
Looking forward to it. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go ahead and forge ahead with our now watching section. It seems strange because I have two comedies to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
And it seems strange to transition into a comedy. But
I've got one truly haunting drama, if that's how you want to start.
Yeah, let's start off with that.
Okay, well, the first movie I'll talk about then is called A City of Life and Death. It's by a Chinese director, Liu Chuan. And this is one of just like the most brutal, haunting movies I have ever seen. It's so hard to watch it because it centers around. Are you familiar with the Rape of Nanking that happened during World War II?
Yes. Yeah.
It's pretty much the most unfiltered look at the evil inflicted on the Chinese people by the Japanese imperialists. This movie came out in 2009, and actually, it's kind of weird that I saw this now because. Christian Bale has a new movie coming out called, like, the Flowers or something like that. And it's also supposed to be centered around this.
Right.
You see the initial invasion, and you are shown it from the perspective of a couple of different Chinese people who, one is a soldier that you see early on in the movie, and then there's a prostitute that's in there, and then there's, like, just a couple of these other characters that you kind of follow along, and it is just uncompromisingly awful and mean to all of the people involved. But it's also very well shot. It's a very beautiful movie. They decided to make it in black and white, so it almost has like the World at War of World War II kind of aesthetic to it. It's really unflinching, and I don't know. It's not like I even want to recommend this movie. I think that you can appreciate it, but you'll never enjoy a movie like this because of just how nasty it is.
Is it like a one and done? Watch it. You're never gonna want to watch it again.
Oh yeah, like I couldn't imagine. And it's also about two hours and 15 minutes. It's a very long movie, and you see, there's really never a break from it either. You don't really get any moment to just. It's like you watch the movie Irreversible.
Yeah.
And there's all that nasty stuff in it. But then there's this one 15-minute segment where you just get to see them be a couple. And it's like, this was a nice little palate cleanser from all of the nasty stuff I just saw. Doesn't really happen in this. And you can tell, like, this is the sentiment still seems to be intact with the Chinese people. They just loathe the Japanese people to this day for what they did. And it's true. I mean, it's the worst atrocity committed in wartime in modern era. What else was I gonna say? That's like a good. That is one of the rewarding things about it is that it is a good depiction of what pure evil truly looks like. And especially when you know that this was real and that all of this happened. And like, and it's so sad, like, from the imperialist side of it, the only character that seemed to have any morality and that was trying to be like, you know, Japan, maybe we should rein this in a little bit, was a Nazi. If you want to know just how evil that were, when the Nazis are telling you that maybe you should
tone it down a little bit,
restrain yourselves a little bit, it's something.
Well, let's cleanse our palate from that a little bit.
All right, so Don Cornelius is dead. Rape of Nanking, and
let's cleanse our palate a little bit with a couple of comedies now. Okay. So, one that you absolutely should not see is Your Highness, which is one from earlier 2011, directed by David Gordon Green. This one's starring Danny McBride, Natalie Portman, James Franco, also Zooey Deschanel is in it. So, you know. A couple of people who have had success in comedies in the past. So in this movie, it's basically Danny McBride and James Franco are two brothers, and they're on a quest to rescue the kidnapped girlfriend of James Franco. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely cannot recommend this movie for any reason. The humor is all very juvenile. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely impossible to root for Danny McBride as a protagonist. Yeah. He is whiny and prone to these temper tantrums where he'll just like, oh, screw you guys, I'm leaving. And he's basically an unfunny version of Cartman. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't say things quite as offensive. That makes him also a little bit endearing. And bad enough things don't happen to him where, you know, he's like an endearing kind of Cartman figure who's just this asshole that's just fun to shit all over. Mm-hmm. The action in the movie, it is sort of a fantasy medieval type movie where, you know, swords and magic, that kind of thing. The action's not particularly good. There's lots of yelling and lots of flailing. So there's absolutely no reason to ever watch this movie. And it's such a strange movie for most of these people to be in. Like Danny McBride.
Well, is there like a lot of anachronistic pot humor as well?
Not
like,
really,
are they smoking a lot of weed in it?
No. There's like one scene where they're... is like sort of implied weed smoking. They're smoking like out of a long, like Renaissance, like Hobbit type of pipe. Uh-huh. You know what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
And it might be weed, but they never really make it very blatant, which is strange because it's definitely an R rating. They say fuck enough times to really hammer home that R rating, but they kind of skimp out on all of the other elements of an R movie. You know, there's not a whole lot of drug use. There's not a whole lot of like graphic violence, and there's not really any sort of blatant sexuality. So it's there's no reason to ever watch Your Highness.
Well, did this come out around the same? Well, no, this came out this year apparently. Well, there was
2011,
also
yeah.
That was it. Harold Ramis that made it. I hate to attribute it to him if it wasn't, but that Year One movie that came out. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. The one with Michael Cera and Jack Black.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like it's the same kind of thing where it's just these kind of really generic, cheesy setups for jokes.
Yeah.
And it's just like playing on the fact that it's from a different time frame or something. I don't know. This movie had looked awful to me. I did not see it, and I really didn't have any interest in seeing it.
Yeah, it was Harold Ramis that did Year One, which is a shame. But
a great director. Why? Why did you do this? I hope the money was worth it.
Is he? Maybe that was how he was getting money together for Ghostbusters 3. Is he involved in Ghostbusters 3?
I would assume so.
Yeah, he's announced as a character. Let me see if I can find who's writing and directing that particular installment of directed. Oh, Ivan Reitman and Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis are writing.
Good.
So yeah, that's at least a step in the right direction.
Indeed.
So also another comedy that I watched recently was Our Idiot Brother, and it was vastly better than Your Highness. And this movie was actually pretty charming for what it was. Written and directed by Jesse Perez, and stars Paul Rudd, Elizabeth Banks, Zooey Deschanel, and let me see if I can find the name of the...
Oh, Adam Scott's in it. That's nice.
Yeah, Adam Scott's in it. I'm trying to find the name of the third
sister.
Emily Mortimer is the third sister. Rashida Jones is also in it. So yes, it's got some pretty cool people. And it's basically this chronically naive sibling of the three sisters, played by Paul Rudd, is bouncing from house to house after he gets out of jail on parole. So he's in jail because he sells pot to a police officer in uniform. So he's this guy. Yeah, that'll get you put in jail, all right. And it was a real funny scene on the setup to the movie where the cop basically asks him, is like pretending he's buying this weed for like his sick wife. And Paul Rudd in the beginning like plays a little dumb with him, like, oh no, I don't know where you can get weed or anything like that. And the guy basically tells this sad story. Paul Rudd feels bad for him and eventually breaks down and sells it to him. Mm-hmm. So that gets him landed in jail. And that's kind of his character throughout the whole movie. He doesn't really go through much of an evolution. He's always playing that nice guy, extremely naive, expects the best out of people, and usually gets him into a lot of trouble. And the arc of the story revolves around the three sisters, who each, you know, have their own issues. The character played by Elizabeth Banks is like this really driven journalist who's, you know, do anything to succeed, kind of fudge the facts a little bit kind of person. And Zoe Deschanel is his lesbian sister who, you know, gets caught up in a sort of web of lies. And Emily Mortimer is like the desperate housewife character who has this husband played by Steve Coogan, who she has a terrible relationship with, and her kids drive her crazy, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So there's some running gags throughout the movie that wear a little thin, like Paul Rudd is trying to, after he gets arrested and put in jail, he goes back to live on this sort of hippie farm where he was living before, and his girlfriend has, you know, shacked up with someone else, kicks him out, and also keeps his dog. And the dog's name is Willie Nelson. And throughout the movie, he's trying to get his dog back, and they just play up that Willie Nelson joke so much that it just gets real, real old. But other than that, it's a pretty charming movie, some good funny moments to it. And yeah, it's hard to dislike this one. I definitely think it's worth a rent.
Very good. So, well, yes. What's interesting that both Adam Scott and Rashida Jones are in this, because Paul Rudd just got added to the cast of Parks and Rec.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's running for the same position that the Leslie Knope character is. So, and he's hilarious because he's just like this grown-up child in it that's just really entitled but thinks he deserves everything.
Yeah.
So, very funny.
Very cool.
Yeah. All right, well, I got one more movie to talk about, and that's Caravaggio. This came out in 1986 by Derek Jarman. And, like, I don't know if you know much about him, but there's a painter I really like, Michelangelo Caravaggio, and this centers around his life. And he's really, I don't know if you're familiar with the term chiaroscuro. It's just like a way of, he's, you know, heavily, like, he didn't invent it, but he's heavily associated with it. And it's very interesting way of doing a biopic about somebody, because there's a lot of, a lot of non-linear stuff, but on top of that, there's three different actors at different ages playing the main character. So you see him as like a boy, and then as like an adolescent, and then as like a full-grown man. And it actually does a pretty good job of chronicling his life, I guess. And they do a fantastic job of actually incorporating his art style into the film itself. Like, there's a lot of scenes that are just set up to look like paintings of his, you know, where there's just like a lot of darkness that surrounds everything, but then just one really vibrant burst of light in the middle of the frame. And a very aesthetically pleasing movie. I thought it was kind of interesting that they use a lot of anachronisms in it, like, intentionally. You know, he was from, like, I think he died in the early 1600s, but you also see, like, trucks in the movie, and you see electricity. There's lights, and there's bicycles. And I'm sure that, I mean, I don't know if he's, it could be that he's trying to make this commentary, like, that this man's existence isn't so different than the existence of people today, or it could just be that it's really cheap and easy to do it this way. Yeah. And it might be, the truth is probably it's a combination of the two. The cast is great. The cast is really awesome in this movie, and a lot of them are, you see a lot of really young performances from them, because Sean Bean's in it, Robbie Coltrane, Dexter Fletcher, Michael Goh, and Tilda Swinton's in it, too. You know, this kind of movie isn't for everybody, and it probably helps if you have an appreciation for the artist before going into it, but I thought it was pretty cool, and it's weird sort of way.
Is that on Netflix Watch instantly?
I got it on Netflix through their disc service. Oh, okay. I might be streaming on there, I'm not sure, but that's how I got it.
Yeah, every movie that I'm going to be talking about in this segment as well is also available for rent through Netflix, but not watching
City of Life and Death, if you do want to, you know, put yourself through it. that is available on Netflix as well.
So the last one I wanted to talk about was Conan the Barbarian, directed by Marcus Nipsel.
The new one.
Yeah, the new, I guess, remake of Conan the Barbarian.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, this is entirely forgettable.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot tell you one damn thing that really happened after the first 10 minutes of this movie.
Yeah.
So it has like this 300 or kind of a combination between like 300 and Braveheart opening, where, you know, he's a child and he's being trained to be this warrior.
Yeah, I remember.
And his family dies.
They released this clip online. Is that the one where he just like runs out in the wood and kills a bunch of people?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, you know, there's it's of course Conan the Barbarian. It's a kind of Dark Ages
hack and slash
action movie.
Yeah.
Ron Perlman's in it too, as nice. Well as Rose McGowan. And, you know,
Jason Momoa? Is he the guy playing Conan?
Yeah, I've never heard of him before this movie.
Does he even come close to rivaling anything that we might have seen from Schwarzenegger?
You know, Schwarzenegger definitely carries the persona of he of himself. You know, he's got that gravitas that he brings to film, which I think when you watch him now, even though Conan, I think, was one of his earlier movies, in retrospect, you watch it and he just carries himself a lot better. He seems more confident. He seems to just inhabit the role more than this guy. Whereas this guy, he's trying to sort of fill those shoes, but do it in a different way. He's definitely more loquacious, even though he doesn't really talk all that often.
Mm-hmm.
He's a bit more, spunky, sarcastic,
yeah,
in certain ways. But definitely more confident, kind of full of himself a little bit. And yeah, it's different, but not in a more interesting way.
Okay.
So I walked away from this movie while I was watching it several times.
Yeah.
And I probably missed huge chunks, but I feel like I've seen it.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those movies. And even though I could not tell you what it's about other than like a revenge story for this race of people killing off his family,
mm-hmm,
I couldn't tell you any of the major plot beats at all.
Yeah.
I watched it like 2 weeks ago. I remember almost nothing about it.
Well, that's probably not even the point of the movie. I think the point is just to maybe appeal to the basest elements and give you that, you know, sword and shield kind of, I guess, fantasy violence of it.
Yeah, maybe.
I mean, did it even deliver that? I mean, do you feel like you got your fill of it?
yeah, I think so.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, it's not something that I'll rent again. Maybe if it's on, like, TNT on a Saturday afternoon and I have absolutely nothing else to do, I'll, like, have my DS play a game while it's on and ignore it again.
Yeah. Okay.
So, any other movies you do want to bring up?
No, that's it.
All right. So, before we move into review, I think it's worth mentioning that The Gray is the number one movie in America.
Nice.
A movie that also, again, stars Liam Neeson as he kind of takes on this new persona as the action star who's got a loved one that's always in distress or absent in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And Liam Neeson seems to be kind of drifting into that genre and also down into obscurity.
Yeah.
And the number two movie in America is Underworld Awakening, a franchise that has already drifted into obscurity.
Oh, that's so sad.
So,
there was a funny, like, there was a funny Photoshop thread on the internet a while ago where they were saying, what if movie titles were more realistic? What if they did a better job of like spelling out what it
right.
was? And they said that that The Gray should be Liam Neeson punches wolves.
Yeah, and I think I might actually go see that instead of The Gray.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's the same exact movie. So let's take a quick break and come back with our review of Pontypool.
All right.
Hey, let's talk about the distractions went on elsewhere. I keep hearing footsteps, baby, in the dark. Oh, in the dark. Why I keep hearing footsteps, baby, in the dark. Oh, in the dark. Thank you.
In Pontypool, a talk radio program reports on a growing disturbance in a small town while holed up in their recording studio. Now, Pontypool, spelled P-O-N-T-Y-P-O-L-L, one word, is available on Netflix Watch instantly and shares quite a bit in common with the sort of holy trilogy of horror, and by that I mean Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead, Day of the Dead.
Yeah.
So, what did you think of Pontypool in comparison to those sort of movies where people are trapped in one particular location and are sort of under duress by this growing, let's look at it as an unknown sort of a force right now?
Well, and I think what's different about it is that the movie starts with them documenting it more than being directly involved in it.
Yes.
Because it's all set in a radio station. And it's not just any kind of radio station. It's just like a... You can tell this guy, he's sort of like a washed-up shock jock. Doesn't really, seem to care that much about his job. And it's just sort of the unbelievable information that just starts flowing in and how creepy and scary all of it is. We're dancing around this. We don't want to spell out too much about what this movie is or where it's going to go. Because it's really an interesting take on kind of a brand of horror that is not really known at all for any sense of originality. A lot of it's really repetitive.
So, to me, this movie was just crazy tense, almost from start to finish. There's this, as they're sort of documenting these events that are going on their talk radio show, there's this sort of questionable information that's coming through.
Mm-hmm.
They're having a hard time getting things confirmed, so they're kind of dancing around it like we're kind of going to try to dance around what is actually going on, because even though this movie came out in 2008, I think this one's definitely worth a watch. So there's
it really did catch me off guard. Like, it's a shame this movie didn't really get more attention when it came out.
Yeah, it is. So there's the possibility that this is a hoax and they don't want to kind of like make fools of themselves on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And the tension mounts as this situation kind of literally comes to their doorstep.
Yeah.
And whereas they are sort of like staying in their broadcast, a couple of rooms, their broadcast area, because they want to continue to report on the situation and give the information to people, it becomes more of a siege. They have to stay in there and they might as well keep reporting because they got nothing else to do.
That's true. Well, I mean, and I wrote this down on my notes, and I think it's kind of a weird way to describe it, but I think it's a perfect way to sum it up. It's like listening to the Howard Stern show live on 9/11 mixed with, like, the classic Art Bell Area 51 radio call-ins.
Yeah.
Like, it's just, you can sense that they don't believe any of this, but then they slowly just start to understand the gravity of everything that's happening around them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a fascinating transition to watch these, and it's really just the three main characters in the story. There's Grant Mazzi, who's played by Stephen McHattie. He's the actual DJ. And then there's just the two producers that he has with him.
Yeah, Grant Mazzi is the radio host, and he's this old veteran of talk radio. He kind of knows how to grab an audience and entertain.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of a grizzled old cowboy of radio.
Mm-hmm.
If you're casting like a bigger celebrity, you might go with like a Tommy Lee Jones type. You wanted to cast a really loquacious Tommy Lee Jones, which would be interesting.
It would.
Because you don't really see Tommy Lee Jones go on for very long.
Yeah.
Also, there's the producer, of course, the character Sydney Breyer, played by Lisa... Oh my goodness, I'm sorry, Lisa.
Howell?
H-O-U-L-E.
Maybe it's Huell, like Huellhauser?
Maybe. And she's the hometown girl of this really small town that they're broadcasting out of. They're sort of like the local radio station.
Oh, and Pontypool, by the way, is actually a town in Ontario, Canada.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's like, I looked it up on a map for whatever reason. It's about 60 miles outside of Toronto, like northeast of Toronto.
Yeah, and she is the hometown girl, and she's got some family issues. Her ex-husband and her seem to share custody with her children. Then also you have your technician, who is this young lady who is also an Afghanistan veteran.
Mm-hmm.
And that trio of characters are the ones who you're mostly seeing throughout the whole movie. And their sort of interaction, trying to get the bottom of this, trying to verify sources, get people to call in and sort of filter out good information and bad information, and also feed information to Grant Mazzi inside the booth. That's primarily the action that's going on. And it's there's also the one more character that I wanted to mention real quick before I moved into another idea is their sort of traffic quote-unquote pilot.
Yes, he's amazing.
And he becomes their, you know, reporter in the field with all like this...
Well, he's like the first guy there, really. Like, he's the first major, what they believe could be credible source of information about
yes.
all of this.
Yeah, and he's... First on the scene to like this sort of riot mm-hmm. that's going on, this craziness involving massive people, and he's a guy who repeatedly calls in, and as you're hearing from him, you're hearing the situation deteriorate, and he's possibly an unsavory character himself. The producer Sydney drops a little hint later on, mm-hmm. and I don't want to give it away, but she. And it's a really, really quick moment, and they move on from it really quickly about how this guy might not be someone that you would associate with in a social situation.
Yeah.
Let's just say. And I think that the movie does a really amazing job with these disembodied voices that are feeding information, like the traffic pilot, and also like the... They get a call from a guy at the BBC mm-hmm. and basically interviews Grant Mazzi about what's actually going on. And Grant Mazzi tries to skirt his way around in that interview
yeah.
to give as much information as possible without actually sounding like a crazy person because it's mm-hmm. all unconfirmed.
Yeah.
And
well, that's one of the, like, and it's more of a subtle thing that makes this so great is it's incredible sound design in the movie. They really do a good job of. Like putting all of these filters and effects over the voices that you hear calling in, and there's just really, I don't know, very, very good use of it, and it creates this very tense setting for it.
I have that in my notes as well. It's just got a phenomenal use of just sounds and voices, mm-hmm. both like ambient sounds as well as recordings, yeah. and how some sounds get recycled throughout the movie. It's really, really great sound mixing. And they also do a really good job in the movie of keeping momentum moving forward without being tedious. It's more than them just taking phone calls and mm-hmm. responding to people who are calling in, describing what's going on.
Well, it's like any good horror movie. It builds. It
yes.
keeps building, you know, as it goes on. It's like every encounter they have, it lends more credibility to everything that happens, and it's making it seem worse and worse every time.
Yeah, and it's also a very... sort of behind the music of talk radio.
Yeah.
He has got the producer in his ear the whole time. He's got the technician sending him text on a computer screen about things he can say next.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very frantic, even though there's not, you know, people running around with guns and stuff, you
yeah.
know? And it's also very, very claustrophobic. You're pretty much just trapped in these couple of rooms with these characters.
Yeah.
There's very scarce exteriors. I think you might see the outside.
You essentially see him driving into work.
Yeah.
Is like the opening sequence. And he has one interesting encounter. We can talk about in spoilers. But like that's pretty much it. And then he gets to the studio. And then that's where the movie is for the rest of the time. And the studio itself is just this really bare bones studio they have set up.
Yeah. And I think that what makes this movie so awesome is that it relies on that tension rather than, you know, like the torture and the gore or
yeah.
like the jump scares that a lot of horror movies and slasher movies and jump scare found footage movies rely on.
Yeah.
And I think we might, even though this movie was... came out like 4 years ago now. I think we might have a little bit of a renaissance going on with the horror genre because our number one movie from 2011 was Take Shelter.
Yeah.
And also Insidious was a solid horror movie last year.
I think it's
nice to see these sort of true horror movies that aren't relying on just making you uncomfortable through corporal punishment.
Yeah.
You know? So yeah, I'm really pleased with this movie. Even though I had a little bit of problems with the last few minutes of the movie, I was a little disappointed. I think without going into spoilers here, I think they tried a little too hard to find or to make a movie about sort of an unconventional source of these riots, whereas in more conventional horror movies, you know, it's they're usually pretty cut and dry reasons for people rioting and causing all sorts of destruction and mayhem. Whereas in this movie, it would have been fine if it was a very conventional disturbance, because it's told in such an unconventional way. But yeah. I think they went for the full nine yards with the unconventional story. And I think that it got maybe a little silly, or convoluted might be a better word, at the end there. Mm-hmm. So for such a small-scale project, it has a great original approach to a sort of established formula. I'm trying to skirt around this as much as possible.
Yeah.
But I don't want to spoil it, because it is a really crazy fun movie. And
Very novel. It's very novel in the way that they made this. And it's genuinely entertaining. And I think it's very scary, too.
And easily accessible. Mm-hmm. Which is one of the big reasons why I don't want to go into any spoilers, because it's so easy to watch.
It really is. Okay, well, and do you want to jump into some spoilers? We can really break down what all is going on in this.
I think what I want to do is actually tack the spoiler section to the very end of the podcast after the top five, so there's no chance you can just kind of stumble into it.
Okay.
So let's put a little tack here. Let's say that we're going to move on into our top five, but at the very end of the podcast will be the spoiler section.
Very good. Yeah, you really don't want to spoil any of this. It's going to be good.
So our top five this week is the top five bottle plays, which I actually don't recommend that you Google, because it brings up something else entirely.
Oh, yeah.
But what we mean by this is, why don't you go ahead and describe it?
Well, essentially a bottle play, what that means is when all of the characters are put into a bottle, or essentially put into a small confined space where they just have to interact with each other and nothing else. So essentially, it could also translate into just like a one-room story, a movie that's predominantly set in one very specific location.
Yeah.
And like with Pontypool, like how Pontypool is essentially, the entire movie is just set inside that radio station.
I also set the limitation on mine where also in a very confined period of time as well.
Yeah, that's
because otherwise you could pick something out of, you could pick Shawshank Redemption. They're confined in a prison.
Yeah.
And but it takes place over, what, 20 years?
Yeah.
So, yeah, that definitely didn't qualify at all.
And all of mine are the same way. They take place with just the events of a day or a few hours even.
And even though I really liked Pontypool, I decided not to put it on this list, because that's probably something I'm going to be doing from now on with top five lists. I'm going to try not to use the movie we just talked about, even though...
But it would be a worthy addition to the list, I think.
No question.
Great movie.
No question. So why don't you kick us off with your number five?
All right, I'm going to go with the movie Wes Craven made a few years ago, Red Eye. Did you see this?
Oh, sure, with Cillian Murphy.
Uh-huh, yeah, and is it Rachel McAdams, I think, is in it?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, and I love this movie. I think it's a great movie. And it's it fits into the one-room movie, because it's all essentially set on... Well, 80 to 90% of the movie is set on the plane itself.
Yeah.
And she's basically being held hostage and is sort of unaware of it for the most part of the movie. Cillian Murphy's character is like an assassin, and he's initially sent there to kind of like woo her and catch her off guard, but at the same time keep her captive so that she can contact her father, because she's part of like this big scheme that they have going. And it's just about all of the crafty ways she tries to escape, even though she's always on this plane the whole time, and how he has to kind of wrangle her and keep control of her. And how he eventually isn't that great at doing it.
Yeah, it's true. It kind of falls apart for him there at the end. But, yeah, I definitely remember. I think I saw Red Eye in the theaters years and years ago. And yeah, I remember.
That's a great movie. I really like it.
Yeah, and, you know, when you compare it to, like, the other plane movie that came out around the same time, I believe it was the one with Jodie Foster, Flight Plan.
Yes, yes.
It's a masterpiece compared to that.
Yeah. Well, it's also a lot more, and that's the thing with a lot of these movies, is that there's a parsimony to them. There's a simplicity, and, like, an elegant simplicity to all of them. And didn't Flight Plan go off on weird tangents, like she was crazy or something?
Yeah, they because she was looking for her daughter, and she got onto the plane with her, and then they tried to play up the angle, like, well, maybe she didn't, maybe she's crazy, maybe her daughter's dead, and she's imagined with her because she snapped.
Yeah.
So, yeah, a little bit of that was going
on.
Well,
none of that happens with Red Eye. You know, it's a pretty straightforward story, and he uses the setting very well. And it's also kind of unlike Wes Craven. You think of Wes Craven as, like, kind of gritty, dark, violent stuff, and this... well, it has a little bit of violence. It's a lot cleaner than a lot of his movies tend to be.
Yeah. So my number five is The Evil Dead from 1981, directed by Sam Raimi.
Nice. That's a great pick.
Yeah, and this one is where five friends are in a cabin in the woods, and they unknowing and unwillingly release these ghosts that possess them and kind of defile their flesh and do really violent acts. And
yeah
it's very gruesome. And gory
and fun. Yeah. And ultimately very fun.
Oh, yeah.
This is a great movie.
Yeah, I really like this a lot. And, you know, there's not a whole lot that I can say about it. I mean, I really like this movie.
I mean, this is one that, I mean, unless you're totally averse to horror, I would imagine that most people have seen this movie already.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of a standard.
Yeah, and Bruce Campbell is in it, and he reprises his role a couple of times in The Evil Dead 2, mm-hmm. which is kind of a remake. You know,
it was.
Except it's just the two characters there, and then of course.
Well, then Army of Darkness goes off and is complete comedy. It's like slapstick.
Yeah.
In a lot of the way that it's set up.
Yeah. So yeah, Evil Dead, my number five.
Well, then I guess on to my number four. I'm going to take back every bad thing I said about Jodie Foster and go with Panic Room.
Oh, okay.
And I like Panic Room a lot. I think it's a great movie, and I think it's really underrated. I mean, people praise Fincher's, and I think this is one of his. This is one where he shows off his technical prowess. More than a lot of his other movies. I think that it's in the nuance and all of the little details he gets to use. And it's a great movie. And it's, of course, all set in, what do they call it? It's like a safety room? The panic room. And it's good. I like this movie a lot. I think it's got some great performances, too. But ultimately, like, really, really well done. Very good use of just a limited space.
Yeah, and that's one that almost made it into my top five, but ultimately I liked these other ones better.
Yeah.
So my number four is Cube, directed by Vincenzo Natali from 1997.
Can you spell that? Is that C-E-W-B? Is that how you spell that?
Vincenzo Natali?
Oh. Cube.
So.
But go on.
Thanks for completely derailing me. But these seven strangers end up in this... endless maze of inside this cube, because all of the rooms are very cube shaped. But there's would you shut the fuck up? How do you want to say it?
I don't want to say it.
Cube? Is that how we say it?
No, you got points to make. I'm really sorry that I'm
just
call it the movie.
God damn it. The movie is a really fun example of these, like, this sort of torture trap horror movie that a movie like...
well, it predicts something like Saw that does kind of the same thing.
Yeah, but I thought it was a little bit more, I guess, cerebral, or maybe psychedelic is a better word than a Saw movie. But yeah, it's really fun. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, I liked Cube, too.
God, I hate you so much.
All right, on to my number three, then. It's The Breakfast Club.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's pretty, a pretty obvious pick, I guess. But it's all set with these kids that are on, you know, are in detention. And, it's a classic film. I mean, who doesn't know about The Breakfast Club?
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, just to comment about why it's a good movie is that, you know, you have all of these kids that come in seeming like stereotypes, and all of them prove to be so much greater than what they would seem at face value.
Yeah, and it's one that I also consider for my list. It ended up on my honorable mentions, but yeah, it's definitely a movie, that's for sure.
Indeed.
My number three is Talk Radio. Am I saying that right?
I think so. I think you got that right. Is it radio?
It's from 1988, directed by Oliver Stone. And it's this about this shock jockey who antagonizes his audience and uses that to boost his ratings. He's very abusive to people who call in and people who are guests on his show. And it's right before he's about to go like to a national audience, and it's sort of his last hurrah as a strictly local guy, and it's just him doing his radio broadcast over a while and kind of wrestling with what he's made his persona into, and wrestling, you know, if he is just playing this sort of contempt for an audience, or if he actually does have contempt for his audience who just hate what he does. But yeah, stars. Wow, you made fun of me for mispronouncing Q, which I'm going to keep calling it that.
Q.
But Eric Bogosian. Bogosian?
Bogosian.
Yeah. And Alec Baldwin's in this movie. John C. McGinley is in this movie. Yeah, it's a cool little cast. And yeah, Talk Radio, my number three.
All right. Well, on to my number two then is Man from Earth. Do you remember, have we talked about this movie before?
I think I've
mentioned it up at one point or another.
I don't remember this one.
It's really low budget. It came out in 2007. It's about a group of professors that get brought together by one of their fellow professors who says that he's going to be leaving and that he has to leave because he doesn't age. And he's the man from Earth. He's been around for thousands of years and he just travels. And all of the people that have been brought together are his fellow professors. So there's, you know, like an archaeologist among them. There's a professor of religion in there. And it's, he basically puts it on them to debunk him, to say I'm wrong and I'll stay. But it's just whether or not he's telling them the truth or whether or not this is just, you know, some sort of lie or fabrication that he has just to mess with them. And yeah, so it's really, it's incredibly low budget. It's not going to be, you know, like this big, you know, like I don't know what to say about it. It's really a great movie. And I think it's just, fantastic just as a script alone. Like this would be just a fascinating read, but as a movie, it's great too.
Yeah. That's a really interesting premise for a movie. And I actually just searched it on Netflix and it is available to watch instantly.
Fantastic. You got to watch this. I want you to think of this. It's a great movie.
It is now in my instant queue.
Oh, and it is really low budget. And, at times there is kind of a cheesy made for TV movie kind of vibe to it, but the script itself totally warrants this movie existing. It's so good.
Very good. So my number two is Hard Candy from 2005, directed by David Slade, not to be confused with David Spade, who did not direct the movie. Fun fact. This one stars Patrick Wilson and a young pre-Juno Ellen Page. And it's basically she poses, or she sort of baits him because he's a pedophile who...
Well, is he a pedophile? Let's not give away the movie.
I'm okay with spoiling this one. But I've already said it. He could or could not be a pedophile, but he is. And it's an interesting question that runs throughout the movie is if she is baiting him and then subsequently torturing him for no reason, or is it this sort of revenge plot? But he poses as a photographer, and I guess he is a photographer because he takes pictures. So, by the very strictest sense, he is a photographer.
Indeed.
And, yeah, and the movie is basically in his house. And
well, she has a reason to believe that he is responsible for the disappearance of a good friend of hers, right?
Yes.
That's the premise going in?
That's the reason for her just completely fucking with this guy and pulling really nasty and disturbing tricks on him. I don't want to give any of that away because this movie is... just so
nasty.
Tense and so hard to watch.
That
that alone is worth watching the movie at least once. I don't think you're going to want to watch it a second time, but this is a movie you should see once.
Indeed.
All right, what's your number one?
All right, my number one is Hitchcock's Rope.
You ever seen Rope? Yeah.
I love this movie.
Sure.
It's a great movie, and I think it's the definitive one-room movie and for a lot of reasons, because going back to the point of parsimony, where it's just all about how simple and streamlined can you make a movie, And this one is, Jimmy Stewart plays a detective, and he believes that there's something going on with the two guys that are hosting this party. He thinks that they're wrapped up in something, and he's determined to figure out what it is. And, you know, they think they're too smart to give away what's gone down, but sure enough, you know, Jimmy Stewart's going to do his thing and kind of try to crack this puzzle. And one of the things I love about it is that it's also shot in 10 scenes. He wanted to make a movie in 10 scenes, and that's exactly what it is. It's a full-length film, too, and it's really clever. And if you watch it, you'll notice there is not a single cut. Like, he doesn't cut. Like, there will be these, like, usually the scenes will last, like, 7 or 8 minutes before he has to cut it. And usually it'll just be, like, somebody walking in front of the frame, so it gives you this sense, even, that these are really just long, continuous shots. And it really lends to the spirit of the film, because it makes you feel like you're trapped in the room with them. It's so claustrophobic.
Yeah, that's I really like setting those sort of limitations out. Like, I'm going to shoot this in 10 scenes and find a way to make a movie within those constraints. I think setting really tight constraints around a film really forces you to be more creative and more innovative than movies that absolutely have no limitations whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's a really great pick.
Yeah.
And my number one is, I'm gonna throw these two together, Clerks and Clerks 2.
These are great picks. I can't believe I didn't even think of these. These are great picks.
They're directed by Kevin Smith, director of such illustrious films as
Red State,
Zack and Miri Make a Porno.
I liked Red State.
And Mallrats. Which is funny, because we can't bring up a Kevin Smith movie without at least mentioning the guy. He has directed some of my most favorite movies, as well as movies that I absolutely hate.
And the former, of course, which is Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back.
Yes. And yeah, I really love Clerks and Clerks 2. They're both movies that center around two characters, Randall and Dante, in one movie they're convenience store clerks, and another movie they're fast food workers. And it's just basically a day in their life at work. Mm-hmm. And all of this shit is going down in their personal lives, and they're having to deal with customers they don't like coming in and out of the store. And you know, it's just so much fun to see these people who are miserable in their jobs pick on people and talk about the issues in pop culture and things like that. It's they're just real fun movies.
Yeah, well, and you also get that kind of it sounds mean to say it's stilted, but it's just so well worded. Like, nobody could have conversations like these in real life.
Right.
They just, the way that they communicate with one another is so fast and so on point. It's almost got like this, you know, 50s screwball.
Right.
With just absolute filth in it. Like, it's a great movie. I love it. And it's a perfect execution of the one room play.
Everyone is sort of, you know, what's the actress's name from Hudsucker Proxy?
Amy Archer?
Yeah, everyone's sort of a version of
Amy Archer. Yeah, that's true. Everyone's trying to be Amy Archer.
Where everyone's always got a witty response to anything that just happened.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I really like those two movies. I think if I had to pick the more favorite one, I'd probably go with Clerks, even though I think Clerks 2 is technically the better movie.
Yeah.
But, yeah, it's both great movies and a lot of fun. Really biting, sarcastic humor. Mm-hmm. So, good times.
Indeed.
So, any honorable mentions you want to throw out?
I did. A couple that you mentioned, actually. Hard Candy and Cube are great picks, I think. I also had Saw on my list.
Wait a minute. Why is this even... What did I say?
Cube. You put a couple W's in there. That's my problem. C-E-W-W-W-B. I'm pretty sure it's how you spell it. Yeah.
I elongated my vowels. I'm sorry about that.
Okay. And ones that I already used. These had already made my list, so I figured I shouldn't harp on them too much. Reservoir Dogs. I think it's great. 12 Angry Men. And My Dinner with Andre.
Yeah, and there are a couple of movies that have been on a bunch of my different lists. Such as Moon, I think he's been on a couple of different lists.
Moon? Is that how you pronounce
it? Yes, Reservoir Dogs.
Alright.
As well as Clue.
Okay, very good.
Clue is not a movie that's been on a list, but everyone's trapped in a house.
Yeah.
And it's got, it's got a mystery.
That it does. You could also use Murder by Death, because Murder by Death is kind of a similar story, where you've got all of the detectives that are trapped in the room together and they have to solve the murder.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and close out the show on
that note. No, we totally derailed. This is so sad.
We're going to play some music in a second. Stick around after the music for our spoiler section of Pontypool. If you've seen it, if you haven't seen it, don't listen to the spoilers, because you should absolutely go watch this movie. So if you want to shoot us an email, if you have any questions, comments, or different takes on any of the movies we've talked about, you can shoot us an email, John, J-O-N, at GamersUnanimous.com.
And I'm Ryan, at GamersUnanimous.com.
Follow us on Twitter, at GamersUnanimous. Like us on Facebook, at GamersUnanimous. And keep up with our blog on MyAGN, at GamersUnanimous. Until next week, everybody.
Later.
Alright, so let's do some spoilers for Pontypool while it's still fresh in our minds.
Okay.
Where do you want to start?
We skirted around using the term zombie the whole time.
We did.
And while they maybe aren't zombies in the purest sense of the word, they are brain dead, violent, shambling monsters.
Yes.
The rioters, as are being documented by the radio play.
And they do bite people, as we learned from Ken, the traffic pilot. Oh, and I do, we say that word traffic pilot.
It's a funny reveal when he's not even, doesn't have a helicopter. Or he's just driving around in his car.
He's in a Dodge Dart. He goes to the top of a hill and he plays helicopter sound effects.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is revealed by the producer. You don't actually ever see Ken.
Yeah. And you hear him documenting the radio, and you can just see it, that's actually a really interesting thing about his performance, is that you just see them react to a lot of what they're hearing.
Yeah.
They do a great job of just emoting how creepy a lot of what they're hearing is. And what you hear from the recordings are, him being confronted by these shambling monsters. Just really creepy stuff.
Yeah. And... well, let's get back to the monsters real quick, the zombies.
Yeah.
So they are... these sort of brain-dead people who are seeking out sound. Now, they're seeking out sound probably for a couple of reasons, but this sort of disease...
Well, a traditional zombie is... there's a virus usually involved.
Yes.
There's something like that. You need to get bit to have it transferred. And this one is different because it's derived from sound. You just hear words that get caught in your mind, and then you just obsess over them until they just essentially just kind of turn you into a blank slate, and you just need to consume more sound.
Yeah, and excuse me, it was a really interesting idea because basically they were saying that either the disease is passed along through ideas or these symbols that these words evoke, or that you basically have it and these different words trigger it.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of fell apart for me a little bit when they started explaining that, because...
well, that was such a goofy setup to bring in. Who was the Dr. Mendez?
Yeah,
that character is just such a B-horror move, to have the guy show up and explain everything to you.
Yeah, yeah, the crazy scientist.
Yeah.
And they do allude to him earlier. It's like Dr. John Mendez.
Yeah.
And he's living in Canada. He's got a Hispanic name, but he's Indian.
But does he speak German or something?
Yeah, it's such a strange character. And it is, it's the sort of crazy scientist character from a B-horror movie. But they really did need to bring someone in to kind of wrap things together. But mm-hmm. once you sort of succumb to this disease, which they allude to is mostly sparked by these sort of terms of endearment, when you say, like, honey or sweetheart, things like that.
Yeah, it seems like that seems to be the root of what is driving, like, the whatever the key word is that sends people off.
Yeah, and then you start obsessing over sounds, fumbling around with your words, and some of the most crazy tense parts of the movie is when the technician starts fumbling over her words, mm-hmm. and then you start to realize that she is getting sick.
Yeah.
And then she starts mimicking the sound of the teapot. God, that was just so creepy.
Yeah, it was.
And they're trying to, like, skirt around her a little bit and kind of get away from her. And then she sort of snaps out of it. They hide in the booth, and she's banging on the window trying to get them to let her in. And then there's the part of the movie where she's basically running into the glass because she's fully succumbed
that's
to this illness.
Pretty much the only point in the movie where it becomes kind of grotesque in any way.
Yeah.
It's the only real major part of violence in it.
Yeah, for sure. And even though it's a scene that we've watched before in other zombie-type movies where, you know, there's the zombie banging on the window trying
where
to
get
in.
Where you have no escape and they're about to break in.
Yeah, it's still so incredibly tense because you're not quite sure what these form of zombies are capable of. Mm-hmm. Because you have so little interaction with them aside from the couple of characters that you get the disease that you run into in the radio station, which is like the basement of a church or something in this town. So, did you want to bring anything else up here in spoilers? What did we...
Well, you just watched the ending. There's a very bizarre little sequence at the end of it, which is totally unrelated to everything else that you've just seen, which features the Grant character and the Sydney character.
Yeah.
Who are in... And it's strikes of like this kind of like Tarantino aesthetic, where they're talking about how they're going to go travel around the world and start like robbing places and
right.
stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's this very bizarre bookend to it. You know, it's like, well, like, did you draw anything from that? Did you have any opinions of it?
Not really, no.
Yeah.
So it starts in black and white and it kind of fades up to color. And it's just, they don't even seem to be in their same characters anymore.
No.
They seem to be totally
I mean, it could be like
people.
A fourth wall joke. Like, maybe. They're trying to wake us out of it. Because that's the whole idea, is that if you're caught in this loop where you're obsessing over a word, you just have to disassociate that word with its meaning. Like, that's a really elegant way he describes it at one point. He's like, you know, when you say the same word over and over and over again, eventually it just loses whatever meaning it once had.
Yeah.
Like, that's, I think that's supposed to be the antidote to this problem that they have. And the movie itself ends, we didn't even talk about how it ends. It ends with the two of them trying to talk to, is it the French? Who is the group?
Some sort of Canadian, former Canadian government, yeah.
Yeah, they're basically going to blow up the building because they think it's the English language that translates the virus.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It doesn't seem like it's just necessarily the English language. It could be transmitted through any, it seems.
Yeah, that's the impression I got. There's a couple of red herrings throughout the movie where they say, you know, it's English, don't speak in English, and mm-hmm. yeah, and it's
and then over the credits they do the same. It's like the same thing they did with Return of the Living Dead, where I don't know if you remember how Return of the Living Dead ends. They finally get the zombie and they put him in the incinerator, and it's blowing like ash all over the town, and then it ends with the zooming to dawn over the city, and then a radio guy comes over. And he's like, it's a normal day in the city. People are reporting a weird itchy sensation, though. And it's just like everyone has just been infected again. And that's what they do with the closing credits of it, because you hear all the voices again, and they're basically saying, well, there's all these weird outbursts of violence now everywhere. So it's didn't just stop at Pontypool, even though they tried to blow the town up.
Yeah, and it's to me, that ending was just a little bit... I guess maybe coincidental that they kind of stumble upon the answer on their first try.
Yep.
It reminded me a little bit of Attack the Block.
I thought you might bring it up. Because that's kind of what they do with the Attack the Block at the end there, too.
They just kind of bookend it like, well, what if this is what's happening? And that just ends up what is actually happening. So it kind of circumstantial, the way it kind of ties all together.
Yep.
Yeah, it's just... so creepy and so tense when you have these sort of like undead, brainless, violent sound seekers, and they mimic certain things that I guess is what their brain are trying to combat. Mm-hmm. this sickness, they describe it in the movie. Well, they'll repeat the same words over and over again as a kind of a way, or same phrases as a way to sort of filter themselves and like kind of their brain's immune system kicking in, trying to fight it off.
Yeah.
But it's the sound of doom coming at you. Mm-hmm. And some people are like mimicking the sounds of crying babies. There's the part where the technician is mimicking a teapot, and just the use of sound invokes so much of the horror in this movie.
Yeah.
So, anything else you want to throw out while we're in spoilers here?
No, that does it. I'm pretty well wrapped up with what I want to talk about.
All right, well, I'm most likely going to be sticking this section at the end of the closing music, just like as a little bookend to the show. So, thanks for sticking around to the end, everybody. And I hope you didn't listen to this without watching the movie, because
you really should.
It's such a unique, original,
and it's enthralling too. Like once you start it, you're gonna get sucked into it.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's just go ahead and close it out there.
All right.
Online, you're on the air. Hello.
Hello, Art.
Yes.
Hi. I don't have a whole lot of time.
Well, look, let's begin by finding out whether you're using this line properly or not.
Area 51.
Yeah, that's right. Were you an employee or are you now?
I'm a former employee.
Former employee.
I was let go on a medical discharge about a week ago, and I've kind of been running across the country. Oh, man, I don't know where to start. They'll triangulate on this position really, really soon.
So you can't spend a lot of time on the phone, so give us something quick.
Okay, okay, what we're thinking of as aliens are, they're extra-dimensional beings that an earlier precursor of the space program made contact with. They are not what they claim to be. They have infiltrated a lot of aspects of the military establishment, particularly the Area 51. The disasters that are coming, the government knows about them, and there's a lot of safe areas in this world that they could begin moving the population to now, Art.
But they're not doing anything.
They are not. They want the major population centers wiped out so that the few that are left will be more easily controllable.
Discharge.
I started getting...
I'm